Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The Great Recession of 2008 was dubbed the man session for how it disproportionately hurt the male U.S. workforce. This time around, as the pandemic lays waste to jobs in the service and healthcare sectors, females are taking the hit. The U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics in April reported a first since they started keeping track of women's employment in 1948, and that is that unemployment numbers for women had hit double digits. And those losses are primarily in low-wage and part-time fields where women make up two-thirds of the workforce. For women of color, the news is worse. Washington Post reporter Samantha Schmidt covers gender and family issues. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me, Ann.
You write that not only are women overrepresented in some of the hardest hit industries, leisure, healthcare, education, but that they lost jobs at disproportionate rates. How can that be?
Yeah, so when you look at some of the hardest hit industries, we see sectors such as education, health services, and retail and hospitality. And women are not only overrepresented in those sectors, but they've actually taken a harder hit by the job losses. So, for example, in education and health services, women held 77% of those jobs, but they accounted for 83% of the job losses. In retail, they made up less than half of the workforce there, but they experienced 61% of the retail job losses. And that's in large part because many of those women held some of the lowest paying jobs, such as cashiers, hotel clerks, office receptionists, hospital technicians, teachers' aides, those kind of lower wage jobs that might be more likely to be laid off, in these kind of early days of the pandemic. And we know that women are overrepresented in those low paid jobs, and so that is believed to be a reason why they're taking a harder hit right now.
Kind of the lowest paid, the ones out front, the frontline people, the tip of the spear versus the executive types and that sort of a thing who could work from home.
Yeah, you think about waitresses and daycare workers and hairstylists and hotel maids and a lot of jobs also that are, involve working with people, right? Women tend to be, a major part of the service sector. And those are a lot of the jobs that end up being lost as a result of social distancing during the pandemic.
Women of color, even harder hit. And I should have to add, as usual.
Yes, definitely. And Black and Hispanic women were both, even though women generally experienced higher unemployment than men, Black women were at 16.4%. That's above the average of 16.2% for all women. And Hispanic women were especially hard hit at 20.2% unemployment.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Today we're talking about the gender gap in the United States, a la the pandemic. I just mentioned a few minutes ago that the Great Recession was dubbed the man session for how it disproportionately hurt the male U.S. workforce. This time around, the pandemic has particularly hurt job sectors where women are predominantly employed, and they also tend to be lower paying jobs, lots of part-time jobs. It is the first time unemployment numbers for women has hit double digits since they started keeping track in 1948. My guest is Samantha Schmidt. She's a reporter for The Washington Post. She covers gender and family issues. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Here's the interesting thing, that even with the recession of 2008, Samantha, women recovered slower than men economically.
Yes, and that was so fascinating because in the early days, everyone was calling it the man session, and we thought that women had the more stable jobs during that time, jobs like in education and healthcare, which tend to be less cyclical than manufacturing and construction. But when we saw some of the public sector job cuts later on, once state and local governments started slashing their budgets, women ended up experiencing a lot more of those job losses, and they hold nearly 58% of public sector jobs. And just to give you some stats there, between June 2009 and June 2011, women lost 281,000 jobs, while men actually gained 805,000 jobs. So in the end, women took a lot longer to recover from that recession. And Black women in particular had a hard time recovering. And they had just now kind of regained those jobs. And now the entire job gains from over the decade have been wiped out as a result of the pandemic.
But it's at lower paying jobs, right? I mean, women are still have made headway into more higher paying salary type positions. But who cares?
Yeah, what's so interesting is there was a lot of excitement at the beginning of this year because women had, for only the second time, reached a major milestone, which is they outnumbered men in the U.S. payroll workforce. That's not including farms, but the payroll workforce. And that was in large part because of those surges in healthcare and education. And we know that the service sector, including in healthcare and education, has been the biggest growing sector of the economy in terms of jobs in this country. And so on the one hand, that's great news for women, but also that might kind of reveal another problem, which is, or conceal another problem, which is that women tend to be in lower paid jobs in those industries. And they tend to be more, the kind of fitting these traditional female-oriented sectors that involve working with people. And so they kind of, some people have expressed concern that that might actually set women back. And some economists at Cornell found that actually the single largest factor accounting for the gender pay gap was that difference in occupations, that because women and men pick different jobs, they tend to pick different industries, that actually is setting women back.
It's such a dichotomy particularly when you compare it to 2008, because I think it was a woman I read about in your article, Samantha, that she had chosen to go into a trade, into the salon industry, because her dad told her, get a trade. You'll always have a job. And likewise, a lot of men who likewise chose trades lost them because of the hit to construction industry when the recession hit.
Yeah, and I think that's what's so tough about some of these jobs that were lost is jobs that usually aren't as, a big of a concern during recessions, right?
We're going to get our hair cut,
Everyone's going to get their hair cut. Everyone has to go to the doctor's office. You've got to go to your dentist to get your cleaning. But, right now, no one's going to the dentist and no one's going to the hairstylist. And the people most likely to lose those jobs aren't the actual dentist at the office. It's the woman who cleans your teeth, the dental hygienist or the receptionist at the front counter, jobs that tend to be overwhelmingly women.
Looking back again at the Great Recession, men suffered greater job losses, but they bounced back faster. A lot of that had to do with how stimulus money was used and invested in the construction and the building and trades, right?
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's one thing that experts are cautioning now, is that we can help to avoid making this worse for women, and that we need to specifically think about how women are going to have a harder time recovering, in large part because they're dealing with a heavier burden of childcare as well. And so, when I talk to advocates, in some of these women's groups, they say that we need to be thinking about childcare. We need to be thinking about helping the industries that are overwhelmingly made up of women, and also making sure that once those public sector cuts are felt, that we're not forgetting about those teachers in those schools that are going to be out of jobs, or the kind of lower paid public employees in different governments around the country who might be losing those jobs as well.
Most single parent families in the country are still headed by women, right? The vast majority.
Yes, definitely. And looking at a report from the National Women's Law Center, they found that not only are two thirds of the 40 lowest paying jobs women, but more than two thirds of mothers in the low paid workforce are the sole or primary breadwinners for their families.
And that has that's the problem. This is so unprecedented that even they aren't going to be able to afford to find somebody to take care of their kids if and when they even can go back to work.
Right. That's the tough question facing so many families right now is, as so many states are starting to reopen, some jobs are starting to come back, but childcare centers might not be reopened. Or even if they are, you have to kind of weigh that risk. Like, you want to put your child at risk of being exposed or bringing that virus back into your home. And, also when you've got two parents, for example, you know, women tend to have the lower salary. And so when you're, you know, when parents are at home talking about how they're going to make this work, you know, how are they going to, you know, handle taking care of a kid over the summer when summer camps are closed and daycare centers are closed, too often women are going to be the ones having to make those sacrifices, especially when in many of these, you know, cities across the country, women are barely making enough to cover those childcare costs. And for them, maybe before, it was worth it still to go to work, even if you're barely covering the daycare center or the babysitter or the nanny, because you think, you know, over time, long term, it's going to mean, you know, more savings, more money. And, it, you know, I want to be able to still work and work on my career. But now, you know, when you're making those calculations, you just might think it might not make sense anymore. I'll just stay home and take care of the kids.
You know, accumulation of wealth, too, is another big factor that we look at when it comes to the gender gap in the United States. And it sounds like from reading your article, at least, that a lot of women that we don't ordinarily, or a lot of people that we don't ordinarily think of accumulating wealth, relatively speaking, meaning being able to buy a house. I mean, people were kind of reaching that point. Women were figuring it out, right? But now what?
Yeah, that was what really struck me about this this woman, Elaine Du Bois in Long Island, who had spent the last decade making a really, you know, a good living off of, I mean, she was working tough jobs, you know, overnight shifts, three jobs at different hotels in Manhattan, you know, and she worked her butt off and was able to raise up money to buy a condo in Long Island for her, you know, her and her son. She's a single mom. She was able to find, you know, affordable childcare when needed, and, you know, her kid was in school and she was making it work. She had a car, she had a mortgage, but now she's fallen behind in her mortgage ever since she's, you know, been out of her work at all of her hotels. She's had to cut her car insurance and had to dig into the little savings she had in order to pay the bills. And, you know, unemployment is just not enough for her right now, unemployment assistance. And so, you know, she really felt like she was making so many strides in the past decade, which really mirrors all of those of the strides for women, you know, in the workforce over the past decade. It had been getting better and better, but, you know, too many women were already, you know, were still just kind of on the cusp, you know, just barely able to kind of living paycheck by paycheck. And, you know, they didn't, maybe there's a lot of families who didn't have that many savings, and the few savings they had are now down the drain.
Any sense about, besides, any sense about how this is being talked about or discussed at the congressional level when they talk about bailing people out?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I haven't been following it as much as my colleagues who cover Congress, but I do know that there's, you know, a lot of demands coming from women's advocates that, again, we really need to prioritize childcare. I think that they're concerned that there's not enough support, you know, and thinking about making sure that daycare centers don't close, making sure you're offering paid leave for families, you know, and that you're specifically supporting single parents, single moms. I know that there's definitely been a lot of demands from different women's advocates and people who think that we just generally aren't thinking about those specific aspects as much when we're looking at aid, as you know, and the decisions we make moving forward.
Well, Samantha Schmidt, thanks for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Samantha Schmidt is a reporter for The Washington Post. She covers gender and family issues. Coming up, we're going to hear more about this, maybe drill down to a little bit more locally and statewide in Ohio. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The Great Recession of 2008 was dubbed the Man Session for how it disproportionately hurt the male U.S. workforce. This time around, because the pandemic lays waste to jobs in the service and healthcare sectors, females are taking the hit. The U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics in April reported a first since they started keeping track in 1948. That is, unemployment numbers for women had hit double digits. Ohio State Associate Professor Wendy Smooth teaches women's gender and sexuality studies. Welcome back, Wendy.
Glad to be with you, Ann.
Kelly Griesmer is president and CEO of the Women's Fund of Central Ohio, which focuses on economic empowerment of women and girls. Welcome back, Kelly.
Hi, thanks, Ann.
You know, Kelly, it seems to me that all of this boils down to the fact that women still gravitate for any number of reasons toward one set of jobs and men toward another. Ergo, the man session in 2008, because so much of that hit the construction and trades and so forth. And this time around, the pandemic, strangely to us, hits the service industries and healthcare and education.
You know, Anne, and that is how we continue to think about it. And that's where we really encourage people that we have to stop. Women don't gravitate to these jobs.
Okay.
These are the jobs that society has required them to gravitate to. Because our systems, quite honestly, were set up at a time in history when there was no recognition that there would be an experience of a woman beyond working in the home. And we've never challenged that, especially in this country. And so even as women have attempted to show that they can be a very active part of our economy and a vital part, especially when they are left due to laws that we have created to raise their families on their own, many single mothers with several people in their family that they're taking care of, we haven't addressed the fact that that experience is something that needs to be that there need to be jobs that fit that experience. And so this pandemic has created really an unprecedented chance for us to say where men have suddenly are experiencing the challenges of there is nowhere for a child to go. And both of us are working and this is how we've been putting it together. They're realizing that a woman has always had this challenge of figuring out what to do with those children when they're sick. And so it's not really that women have been gravitating to those jobs. They've had to go to the jobs that allowed them to manage all these different facets of their lives. And quite often, the jobs with the best benefits or the best wage benefits didn't provide the flexibility or the other benefits needed to juggle the many things they had on their plate.
Yeah, Wendy Smooth, that there's this underlying separation of the systems, as Kelly Griesmer just described. What do you make of that long term? Do you see the pandemic and the wreckage of it economically as an opportunity in that way?
Yes, I very much agree with Kelly's comments, and I also would uplift work that the Women's Fund and other community actors have been a part of to help us think about the gender norms and gender messages that we send at a very early age to girls and young women about the types of occupations that are even considered appropriate for them. Though we have well over 50% of women attending colleges and universities, we still do see some very gender lines of demarcation in terms of the types of occupations that women, college-age women, will select. And some of that has to do with the messaging that they receive as early as middle school about the types of appropriate places for women. And those messages can be really quite subtle. I uplift the work of the Women's Fund and other community leaders in helping us be aware of those types of gender norms. What I would say about what the pandemic is revealing for us is that it will not change our behavior, our messaging, our norms, our actions without intentionality. In 2008, when we realized the man session and the abundance of care work that was left to do in 2008, that some men began to take up, we did not put in place the types of policies and support out of 2008 that would actually enable men to be more active in care work and providing care work. We did not change our social norms and messaging around welcoming men into care work that we could have in 2008. So in 2008, we missed an incredible opportunity to shift gender norms in this country, as Kelly is uplifting as well. And without intentionality in this pandemic, we will likewise miss the opportunity to shift gender norms and gender constructions that are both structural and socially based.
Hmm. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the gender gap. It's bigger than ever now that the pandemic has hit and lays waste to jobs in the service and healthcare sectors. Females are taking a huge hit. The U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics in April reported a first. Unemployment numbers for women had hit double digits. My guests, you just heard Wendy Smooth. She's an associate professor of women's gender and sexuality studies and political science at Ohio State. Also with us, Kelly Griesmer. She is president and CEO of the Women's Fund of Central Ohio. What do you think? What kind of policies out there do you think that they could endeavor to enact even that would change this ingrained trajectory? 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Kelly Griesmer, you focus primarily, obviously, Central Ohio, the Women's Fund of Central Ohio. Pre-pandemic, how was Central Ohio doing, say, compared to national averages when it came to women's welfare and well-being and wages?
You know, Central Ohio was not very different than anywhere else in the country is what we found, despite the fact that Central Ohio is often represented as having a much more active economy, being better than the curve in a lot of ways. We were not better than the curve at all with regard to women's wealth gap. The pay gaps are essentially the same in Columbus when you just think about salaries, you know, and what's most important is that this is where you have to look at the intersectionality of gender and race. Because even if the average woman, if there is any such thing, was making 82 cents to the dollar on average of a man, what we saw was that that is not the case. It's much lower for women of color. And what's even worse is that when you look at wealth, which is the issue that we were most focused on, to the earlier points this morning about women don't accumulate wealth. Mm-hmm. So even if we solved the pay gap today, they don't have the same ability to keep their home, to have a good mortgage. And that's because of the burdens of things like childcare and taking care of the elderly and no access to adequate affordable health care and childcare, which is the one that's really coming out as part of the pandemic. And so we know there's these accelerators of wealth, which is the ability to not only make it day to day, but to put some money away or to own a home. And we see that that's not happening anymore in Central Ohio for women. And in fact, you know, the average a Black woman in Central Ohio, just like across the country, owns about 2 cents to the dollar that a single white male owns. And that's staggering. And that was before the pandemic. And we found nothing to dissuade that Central Ohio was doing any better at that than the national average. And so we have to realize that if those women did not have wealth before this pandemic started, it is absolutely key to our economy and to fixing poverty generally that we pay attention to their inability to accumulate wealth and childcare and affordable health care and paid family leave. Those are all things that would accelerate our economy because it would accelerate those women's ability to accumulate wealth.
Yeah, Wendy Smooth, that accumulation of wealth, I think that distinction between what we earn versus what we own is so critical, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. There's a really incredible classic book called Black Wealth, White Wealth that really looks at some of these fundamental questions about the differences in terms that go back generations in terms of the transference of wealth from one generation to the next. When we look at African Americans in particular, that history is rooted in long-term lack of opportunity to be able to accumulate and maintain land ownership. So when we, the thing with this pandemic and that I've been so struck by, none of these problems are new problems. They are amplified in the pandemic. And this goes back to Kelly's point about opportunity. We really do have an opportunity in this moment of the pandemic to take a look at the kinds of long-term policies that are negatively impacting women's opportunities in our community. And we do have organizations like the Women's Fund, like the Columbus Women's Commission, that are asking these questions, that are pushing around policy questions, such as our eviction policies in Central Ohio are disproportionately impacting single mothers and leading their families and being able, forget about being able to maintain wealth, but actually to maintain shelter for your family, which so many Central Ohio families led by women are faced with right now in the pandemic and were faced with prior to the pandemic. So it's an opportunity for us to double down on looking at questions of the cost of affordable child care, looking at questions of paid family leave. If any time we see the importance of paid family leave in this country, we see it with the pandemic. Affordable health care. Not these kinds of antiquated eviction policies that we see in Central Ohio. We really have a real moment to act and act on behalf of Central Ohio families, many of whom are led by single women.
And yet, you know, I put this to both of you. This is, we still haven't been able to pass the Equal Rights Amendment in this country. It's come to almost a complete stop, except for, was it Virginia recently?
Yeah.
You know, it seems like when Kelly Griesmer, it's framed in terms of women or in terms of any particular group, there's not the same motivation to do anything about it.
Well, that's absolutely correct. And I think that it is because of I couldn't agree with Dr. Smith more that it's about intentionality. We aren't actually thinking about women's perspective and how they work day to day. Women have become leaders by the sheer force of will that they have agreed to try to have all experiences. And one of the things I think that people aren't talking about enough right now is that despite all the troubles that women are going to face because of this pandemic, they are also showing themselves as some of the most effective, if not the most effective leaders in this world when it comes to this crisis. And there's a lot of thought about that. But it's because women, many people say it is because women have this ability not to just be better empathetic people or to be better, thinking about others. It's because they have such a versatility. They have had to experience all experiences. And when we see these things like the Equal Rights Amendment never passing, it's because the easy thing to do is retreat to what the founders of this country, of this world, decided was going to be the case many, many, many hundreds of years ago, thousands, billions of years ago, and we have never challenged it. And each time that we have a little bit of progress, people decide it's okay. And when women succeed by sheer force of nature, people decide it's okay and that it's over and it's done. And as someone who's gone through many years of my own career now, mm-hmm. I can see all the times throughout those many years that people decided things were okay and that we had finally been given enough opportunity. It's even to the point now where there is, you know, a professor in Michigan that's suing institutions over Title IX because he's decided that since there are as many women in college as men now, if not more, we don't deserve any additional opportunities. And that comes down to a misunderstanding of equity. Equality only comes when there is equity. And the fact that there are more women in college is a wonderful thing, but it doesn't mean that they're going to have equitable opportunities or the ability to accumulate wealth when they come out of college. And so we're not equal just because we're now able to get through the door. And too many people want to make that an easier answer than it is.
I think it's sort of astounding when we hear over and over again, Wendy Smooth, that when women on are on company boards, when women are in leadership positions, high leadership, top level in companies, the across the board, they do better. Not they as the women, but the companies. So the statistics, it's all there in black and white. And yet again, what I sense is more of a resistance to doing it for women versus doing what's right.
Yes. I am always, at this point, I should not be astounded by this because I've been teaching this class for a billion years now. But I teach a course on women, gender, and public policy. And I love to ask my students the question, do we have, did the Equal Rights Amendment pass? Or I will read off the elements of the Equal Rights Amendment. And the students are incredibly deer in headlights, shocked and stunned and amazed this year in 2020 mm-hmm. that these policies do not exist on the book. And so one of the things that I would say is that it requires us to be diligent in repeating the messages that women are achieving in spite of the structural obstructions that are in place to defy their achievement. Intestinal fortitude that we hear time and time and again about women leaders. I want to speak to this point about empathy because I do not want us to think that automatically because we have women leaders that they're automatically more empathetic. What we have to do is look at the experiences that women leaders bring to the table. It's because they've been tried in their own personal experiences and are self-reflective about the ways in which they've been tried and challenged. And we only get to that point as a community, as a nation, of being self-reflective when women are given opportunities to tell their stories. Here in Central Ohio, we can use the example of Dr. Atkins. It's not just that because she's a woman leader, that she's able to see all of these various social determinants of health.
But just Amy Acton, who's the director of the Department of Health. Yeah, go ahead.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So it's Dr. Acton also talking through and talking very clearly and distinctly about her own experiences growing up and the ways in which she's been extraordinarily self-reflective about the ways in which she has been touched by various community experiences that lead her to think about public health in a very broad manner. That is why we wanted to talk about her in the New York Times in terms of thinking about her leadership style as being very different than what we were seeing among other leaders across the country in response to the pandemic. So what we want to make sure that we're doing is not ever saying, and I definitely know that the Women's Fund definitely takes this approach of thinking about the experiences that culminate to shape women leaders. The Women's Fund and other leading organizations across the country offer us spaces to talk about the differences that women experience in the workplace, the differences that women experience in university life, where they are learning about their future careers. When we provide spaces for women to talk about their experiences, to process those experiences, that is when we start to see a different type of leadership emerge from women. So we have to also make sure we're providing those spaces for women to process the differences in how they move through their career experiences and through their educational experiences.
We are going to be right back. That's Wendy Smooth. She's an associate professor of women's gender and sexuality studies and political science at Ohio State. Also with us, Kelly Griesmer. She is president and CEO of the Women's Fund of Central Ohio. If you have a question or comment about this topic of the gender gap in the wake or in the midst of this pandemic, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the gender gap and how the economic fallout of the pandemic has widened the economic disparities between men and women, especially women of color in the United States. Still with us by Skype is President and CEO of the Women's Fund of Central Ohio, Kelly Griesmer. The Women's Fund of Central Ohio is focused on the economic empowerment of women and girls, and we'll post a link to their website on our website at wosu.org/allsides. Also with us, Ohio State Associate Professor Wendy Smooth. She teaches women's gender and sexuality studies and political science at Ohio State. Again, questions or comments, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We were talking about women leaders, Kelly Griesmer, and it reminded me when I was listening to Wendy of a story I read about you when you were at a law firm, and one of the partners was saying to one of your male counterparts, "You got great leadership abilities, and you, Kelly, you're a great listener," or something like that.
Yeah.
You made the point to say they were both considered compliments, but they're in different categories.
Yes, and I think that's exactly it, is that, our message is not that I've had amazing male mentors in my life and people who have actually sponsored me to levels of success. That doesn't happen enough, and it needs to happen more. But I can still tell you that at various points, you see those moments where we retreat to these norms and these unconscious biases that exist, and people just look at you differently and say, even though I know you've been a critical part of this team or of this company, you're clearly not the one who's going to be the next leader. And yet when you ask them why, they can't articulate it. And it's so important that it is, as Dr. Smooth said, these unconscious biases and these norms that if we are not intentional about noticing them in ourselves, every single one of us, women and men, if we're not intentional about noticing those with regard to gender and race, we cannot fix it. But the business case is that if we are intentional about it, we will be so much more prosperous together. I think that it's the hard part is that a lot of times people would look at me with a very blank face when I pointed out to them that they were underestimating me still, despite maybe a title I had or anything else, that they were still very much underestimating our abilities as women to lead or to have a very powerful impact in the same way that our male colleagues do. And so it's something we need to do together, and we need male allies and male sponsors and people out there talking with us as partners in this work.
You know, I feel like I've been having this conversation, at least for a billion years, for at least 40 years of my career. It's always the same thing, Kelly. It's always the same issues. Nothing changes, or does it? Have we done anything to change it?
Well, I do think that there's a little bit here about vulnerability, and that's really hard for people. And it's one of the number one things I talk about. I was having a conversation with a gentleman, a lovely person, the other day, and he started just volunteering to me how hard the pandemic was, that he had to tell his colleagues he really couldn't get on the phone until about noon every day. He had so much to do with his child and his working mother, his working wife, his wife, who was the mother of their child, and that he just, and he felt so bad that he couldn't get back to people as quickly as he had in the past. And I sat there quietly for a minute and thought, what do I do in this moment? Mm-hmm. And I decided I needed to speak out loud. And I said to him, "You realize, with great respect to you, that this is what working mothers, how they feel every day, mm-hmm. not in a pandemic." And he just looked at me. And then we had a moment together, a true perspective building moment. where I thought about how new this was to him, uh-huh. and he thought about how not new it was to me and so many others. And if we work on that vulnerability with some intentionality to understand those blind spots, maybe we won't talk about it for the next billion years. But it does require vulnerability, and people are afraid of that.
Yeah, Wendy Smooth?
Yeah, that's a beautiful moment of enlightenment, Kelly, that you were able to participate in. You know, I think also as we see more people understanding that perspective, we really do need policy leadership around workplace equity that we can actually allow people to come back into the workplace or even experience this work-from-home environment in an equitable manner. So this is really a time for leaders to think about and to ask the question, how are you doing to their employees? And not a how are you doing in the sense of, you know, how you feel in the day, but a really how are you doing it? How are you managing the work-from-home environment in light of the many obligations, not only for child care, but also for elder care, because many people are managing the shopping list and the medication and pharmacy runs for their aging parents and the like, or community friends. The question of how are you doing allows an opening into thinking about how can we adjust expectations for work requirements during the pandemic, and to not default to this position that women and others who are responsible for care work cannot cut it, that we can't put them on an aggressive track, that they need to be on the so-called, you know, years ago we used to talk about the mommy track in law firms and in other professions. But we have to acknowledge that care work is a real thing and that it is differential according to gender in this country still. And until we do that and we lead from that perspective and we talk to our employees about their experiences and how can we assist, how can we make adjustments in our expectations, we will continue to penalize women and others who are disproportionately responsible for care in their homes and in their communities. We need some real direction from policy leaders about how to do that, and from industry leaders to be explicit about how they are enabling their employees to do well while working from home during this pandemic. How are we adjusting expectations? What kinds of intentional conversations are we having to make sure that people are able to contribute, to not be penalized for the long run in terms of their career advancement because of their care responsibilities in the face of the pandemic?
How, you know, Kelly, do you think what impact we've had on our changing attitudes, or I should say changing lexicon, because women have been disproportionately working multiple jobs and raising families, often alone, for a long time now. But now it's sort of been recast as this gig economy thing. We're supposed to have this patchwork quilt to generate income to pay the bills. And I'm wondering, women cannot be helped by this kind of approach to work life.
No, we can't. And I think Dr. Smooth is pointing out something so important. There was a headline I saw the other day that, you know, our formal economy is subsidized by women's unpaid work. And to me, that struck me as exactly the issue, and that because we just believe that this unpaid work is what women owe to make the rest of the world work, then it's also assumed that women will paste it together in this gig economy, or, you know, that they will work as a hairstylist in off hours that can be flexible, instead of just realizing, like, these people drive our economy and deserve to have a normal work day just like everyone else, and not to have to split, run from one spot to the next and that our economy will be the better for it. And certainly childcare, I think, is the issue that is becoming the most visible right now, because, you know, as we worry and we so much about reopening an economy, to me, the fact that childcare isn't front and center in how you reopen an economy, when you know, even if a woman is pasting it together in a gig economy, the number one thing that she cares about is, if she has children, mm-hmm. where are they and are they safe? And we are giving them no choice but to choose between the safety and care of their children and our economy. And there are ways to, you know, Australia immediately put, it's going to cost them $1 billion, but they kept their childcare industry alive. And then because they truly believed it would keep their economy alive. And there are most countries across this world have figured out that piece. And yet we struggle so mightily with it here. And so I think, you know, the child care is, you know, if we know that women bear the children and many times then also raise them on their own. And until we realize that that is an experience that is a valuable piece of our economy and they just need the same structures as anyone else would need to have a normal work day and to give back in the way that they so desperately want for themselves and the rest of us.
But, you know, Wendy, we don't value child care workers. We don't, you know, teachers fight in many parts of this country for even living wages. Lots of teachers, public school teachers, are working second jobs to be able to afford a mortgage. We don't pay them enough money.
Absolutely. And talk about moment of opportunity. I don't know a homeschooling parent who is not ready to stand in front of the state house and clamor for better wages for teachers, because we have truly undervalued the work that they do and contribute to our children every day. We also can think about elder care workers who also are part of this line in ways that we could have never imagined, are also incredibly underpaid, and we know the gender dynamics of those employment sectors. Mm-hmm. The piece that I so echo with Kelly, and I also want to uplift, we really do have a moment of possibility for a bipartisan level of support for family and medical leave, paid family and medical leave in this country. We've heard the president actually gesture to that area of policy, and it's been an area of policy that we have heard brought up for a billion years, if you want to use our cliche phrase of the day. But this really is an opportunity, because as we return to work, we have to return to work knowing that if we are or become ill, that we have jobs to come back to, one, and that we can continue to support our families if we fall ill. And this is for the long term. These are the learning outcomes that are possible out of the pandemic. For us to reassess our positions on paid family leave, that is also what separates us from a number of countries that have been able to return to work successfully and to open their economy successfully. They have paid family leave policies. If we expect people to be able to return to work with confidence that they can become ill, maintain their jobs, and also maintain income if they are to fall ill, then we are opening our economy up in a futuristic way. So again, I think that we have a really incredible moment. And I think that there is at least the semblance of bipartisan support for paid family leave.
Wendy Smooth, Associate Professor of Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies and Political Science at Ohio State. Thanks as always for your time.
Thank you for having me, Anne.
And Kelly Griesmer, President and CEO of the Women's Fund of Central Ohio. Kelly, thank you so much. Let's not wait another billion years.
I agree, Anne. Thank you so much.
That's it. Thank you for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.